Welcome to CCNA 1, Module 2. This is a re-record of the module and may contain different material to the original lecture delivered last week. Today we're going to talk about a number of things. We're going to talk about networks and their evolution. We're going to talk about bandwidth. We're also going to explain why layered models are used to describe networking concepts, and we'll discuss briefly the similarities and differences between the OSI or Open Systems Interconnect Reference Model and the TCP/IP network model. First of all, it would be useful to discuss why networking came about and why business finds networking such a unique and useful tool to increase their productivity. The desire to build data networks arose from companies with multiple microcomputers. As you will know, in 1977, Apple Computer came out with one of the first microcomputers, known as the Apple II. People started buying these computers and using these for business applications. For example, a couple of the more popular applications used in business were VisiCalc and DBase, being a spreadsheet and database respectively. One of the problems with having multiple computers in a business, however, was the inability to efficiently share information between the computers. There is a term dubbed sneaker net, due to the fact that a person walks around the office, possibly wearing sneakers, carrying floppy disks to move data between computers. And this term can be looked up on Wikipedia. And basically, it is very difficult to keep a sneaker net, a network, in sync, because if two people change a file at once, then either one person's changes are lost when it's copied over onto the master disk, or you need to hand merge both changes into the text file. Obviously, a better solution was sought. And in the early to mid-80s, various vendors began producing and selling networking equipment. One of the big problems with this networking equipment, however, was that there was no formal standards to actually specify whose equipment should interoperate with whose, and all companies were in competition with each other. This meant, for example, that Novell was probably unlikely to interact with Lantastic, and neither of those would interact with Banyan Vines, and nothing was going to interoperate with IBM LAN Server other than more IBM LAN Server and LAN Manager clients. It was felt that if networking standards were standardized, this would allow a broader adoption of the technologies and much increased interoperability. Of course, whilst LAN or local area network topologies were very popular in the early to mid-80s and in fact into the late 80s, companies found that LANs were essentially little islands of computers. Information could be shared among the little islands, however, larger scale deployments were still not a reality. This resulted in the introduction of metropolitan area networks and wide area networks. A metropolitan area network is a network that covers, for example, a town or city and links various sites together in that locality. A wide area network is exactly what it says, a network that exists over a very wide area. To take an Australian example, there may be machines in Sydney linked to Melbourne, Canberra, Darwin, Perth, Adelaide, and all of the other capital cities. Or, for example, there may be machines all linked together across a specific state, for example, in New South Wales, Sydney, Newcastle, Tamworth, Gosford, Armidale, etc. These LANs usually connect together via lower speed links into wide area networks. Whilst we're talking about words that end with AN, a SAN is a storage area network. This is a network that often contains redundancy, such as RAID, which is redundant array of inexpensive disk drives, and also contains high-speed data paths between various storage devices. It is designed to provide a cohesive storage network, cohesive being a network that all works together or sticks together, a bit like a bowl of corn flour and water, and hopefully a reliable network as well as being cohesive. A personal area network, on the other hand, is a network that is generally limited to a person or their immediate area. Examples of personal area networks include infrared or IRDA technology or Bluetooth. The suggested range of Bluetooth is approximately 10 meters. This is usually sufficient for devices such as pagers, mobile phones, and personal digital assistants to communicate with each other. However, it precludes longer distance communications. Note that some manufacturers have violated the Bluetooth standard and have increased transmit power to allow distances of up to 100 meters. However, these distances usually involve line-of-sight communications, and communications are somewhat unreliable when there are objects such as brick walls, tables, people, and computers between the sender and the receiver. Whilst the evolution of computers is covered quite well in your notes, and I encourage you to look at your notes for details on this, a few key points are in order. In the early 40s, computers were originally designed to assist people in code breaking and repetitive mathematical calculations. These computers contained hundreds and thousands of valves, which were prone to failure, and could usually operate for up to 5 or 10 minutes at a time without there actually being a problem. In 1947, however, the semiconductor transistor was introduced, which basically paved the way for making much smaller electronic devices. Valves, if you've ever seen them, are quite bulky. Some valves are, say, 4 to 6 centimeters high and 2 to 3 centimeters across, have an outer coating of glass and all sorts of funky things inside them that actually do the switching. They also require an incredible amount of power to warm up the heating element, etc. We do not go into valve theory in this course, however, I'm sure a little research will give you all you need to know about valves. In the late 50s, integrated circuits were invented. This allowed people to pack hundreds and thousands of transistors, now millions, onto a single wafer of silicon. In the 60s, we had mainframe computers, which utilized punch cards and paper tape to obtain their data input. In the late 70s, as previously stated, Apple came out with their first personal computer. IBM followed suit in 1981, and they brought out the original IBM PC XT. In the mid-80s, personal computers really began to attain acceptance in homes of hobbyists and interested people. People began to share files with modems, and these systems that were generally central points of file sharing were known as bulletin board systems, or BBSs. One of the drawbacks, however, with bulletin board systems was that you needed one phone line and modem for each user to connect. So, for example, if 50 users wanted to connect to a bulletin board system, you needed 50 lines and 50 modems. This meant that BBSs didn't really scale to large-scale access. There were data services such as CompuServe and Genie, although these were charged at dollars a minute to allow the companies to be able to recover the cost of their modems and phone line investment. Other popular bulletin boards of the time included FidoNet, F-I-D-O-N-E-T, and various other echo-based mail systems. These mail systems allowed bulletin board operators to transfer mail between various systems late at night when telephone rates were at off-peak levels. This would mean, say for example, that a bulletin board in Sydney would dial up a bulletin board in Tamworth, for example, and transfer information at midnight. The Sydney bulletin board would then dial up, say, a bulletin board in Scotland, and these international echoes would happen every few days. This, of course, the cost of which was often borne by the people who ran the bulletin board, or it was paid for by the subscribers to the bulletin board system if they paid a subscription. During this time, however, the US Department of Defense had been busy designing a global fault-tolerant network known as ARPANET. This network had been designed to withstand a possible nuclear attack. The Department of Defense wanted the ability to communicate between separate locations on Earth reliably, even if one of the locations that would normally be used to do communications had been destroyed by a nuclear strike. The Department of Defense was not working alone, however. They also brought in educational institutions such as universities, so they managed to get significant boffin power to allow the internet to evolve. It was a network that was free for research and development. This network, however, was only accessible to those either working for the Department of Defense, those with a special interest, or those involved in a university or educational institution. This network was growing in popularity from the 60s through to the 90s, and I would say that in about 1995, the internet really became a home word or a home concept, with regular, everyday people getting on the internet. It is interesting to note, however, that companies such as Microsoft did not see the internet as the way of the future until 94-95. I recall that when I was at TAFE in 93-94, and we had just, or 94 in fact, we had just got our internet connection. We were a very lucky technical college at that time, and Microsoft was still touting the value of the Microsoft Network, which was going to be a system that home users would dial up and get all sorts of information such as movie tickets, shopping online, etc. Microsoft honestly believed that this Microsoft Network would follow in the footsteps of things such as CompuServe, Genie, and so on. How wrong they were proven to be. The internet took off as nobody expected it would, and before long we had all sorts of commercial entities on the internet buying and selling products. This, of course, resulted in its own set of problems. I remember receiving my first spam message, or a junk mail message, in late 1993. The subject line proclaimed, make.money.fast, and the message assured me that if I sent $5 to the people that were on the list, and there were five of them, that pretty soon $5 notes would be turning up in my inbox, in my post office box, at a speed that I would not be able to believe. Unfortunately, such a plan relies on everybody to be honest, and everybody to send $5 to everyone on the list. If you join the plan when it begins, you're not going to earn any money. But if the plan gains momentum, then you will theoretically get a lot of money in your inbox. However, it was proven that this scheme, make.money.fast, was not likely to succeed. Many junk and spam email messages have graced my inbox since 1993, and it's one of the unfortunate side effects of the modern internet, the amount of commercial and junk email. We're now going to digress and talk about a number of network devices. Network devices are obviously devices that are used on a network. There are two types of network devices, broad classifications, end-user devices and network devices. End-user devices are devices such as computers and scanners and printers. Networking devices are things such as hubs, switches, etc. PCs are connected to the network with a network interface card. The card allows the PC to be connected directly to the network infrastructure so that you can send and receive email, print to network-based printers, etc. It's also useful to note that end-user devices are referred to as hosts. The hosts can exist without the network, however, their functionality is greatly reduced. There also are a number of networking devices, which we will cover briefly here. However, note that as the course progresses, we will go into each of these devices in far more detail. These devices include hubs, repeaters, switches, and routers. A network interface card is a printed circuit board that plugs into a computer. Some of them plug into ISA slots, PCI slots, or PCI Express slots. There are also other types of network interface cards that plug into buses such as PCMCIA, now known as the newer standards, now known as Card Bus, or Express Card. PCMCIA cards are a credit card sized a device that slide into laptop computers. They have been superseded by Express Card and other technologies, however they are still in wide and common usage. A repeater is a device that regenerates and amplifies a signal. It is designed to restore signals once they have been either attenuated or become weakened in transmission. They're used to extend cable lengths. They do not make intelligent decisions as to which signals are going to be amplified or repeated. Hubs are devices that allow multiple devices to be connected into a network. Passive hubs simply allow all of the devices to be seen by the network. This means that if you're running a network sniffing application and you're using a hub, you will see all traffic that traverses the network, as the hub does not filter any of it. It takes input from one port and sends the packets out every other port. There would be no benefit in sending packet out the same port it was received on. Active hubs, however, do regenerate signals and amplify them. A switch is a device that decides whether or not to transfer data based on the MAC address. It has a table called a CAM table, and it learns which MAC addresses are located on which ports. Once it has this information, it then only forwards packets destined for various MAC addresses to certain ports. A switch micro-segments the network into small individual segments. This will come up in your test in one of the modules between now and the end of CCNA 1. It does improve network efficiency as the lines are not saturated with traffic that does not need to be there. Switches will be covered in greater detail further on as we progress through the course. A bridge is a device that can perform data format changes and can also connect multiple networks together. You can use them, for example, if you are converting between fiber and Ethernet. Bridges do make intelligent decisions as to which traffic is going to cross the bridge or not, and they do this using a number of algorithms that often base their decisions based on MAC address. We will talk about the MAC address in a moment. A router can have all of these capabilities mentioned in the previous devices, but it also has the ability to connect LANs to wide area networks. It often makes its forwarding decisions based on layer 3 addresses, which we'll cover further on in the module, and it can make intelligent decisions on the rate and which traffic should and should not be transferred between LANs and WANs. Now we're going to discuss network topologies. There are two types of network topology, the physical topology and the logical topology. A number of topologies will now be presented. A bus topology is where all machines are connected by one big long run of cable, which is terminated at both ends. Some of you may remember 10Base2 or 10Base5 coaxial cable, where the bus is terminated at both ends with terminators. A break in any connection along the bus, the length of the bus, will cause the network to stop communicating. There are two common types of logical topology. There is a broadcast topology, such as Ethernet, where there is no order to how the stations should use the network. However, there is a protocol. This will be covered later in the course. There is also another logical protocol called token passing, where a token is passed from station to station, which optionally carries information on the token. We do not cover Token Ring extensively in this course. We will now go on to discuss protocols. Protocols are a series of rules that computers use to agree on how data and information is transmitted over a network. These include the physical connections, voltage levels, the way bits are transmitted, how data is grouped together into frames and packets, and other such things as timing, error correction, retry algorithms, etc. There are a number of groups that set protocol standards. They include IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, ISO, the International Standards Organization, and the EIA, the Electrical Industry Association. There is also ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, and the TIA, the Telecommunications Industry Association. All of these groups work together to set standards that are theoretically meant to be interoperable with each other. As previously stated, local area networks consist of computers, printers, scanners, network interface cards, networking media, and networking devices such as hubs and switches. Note, however, that local area networks are usually confined to a small geographic area, either a school, a campus, or a particular branch of a company. Wide area networks, on the other hand, usually occupy a much larger area, hence the words local and wide area networks. Wide area networks have also allowed people to become what is called telecommuters. These people don't even have to leave their homes when they want to do work. They can work on company information over the wide area network. Note, however, that this does have some serious security implications which do need to be taken into consideration when people become telecommuters. Now, note that all of these LAN technologies are covered significantly in your notes, and I'm not going to read the notes piece by piece on all of the technologies. I'll just generally be talking about the difference and how these technologies fit in. It's also possible for metropolitan area networks to be built. These can often be connected together with service provider networks to connect the various LANs in the city or the town together, or you can beam wireless signals over public areas, and there is actually a Cisco course, which we're not running at the moment for the CAVI program, known as the wireless course, which can teach you how to set up some of that equipment. That is not available at this time yet, however. It is also important to be familiar with the term virtual private network. A virtual private network is a private network that carries its traffic encrypted over the internet at large. They are used to allow point-to-point connections for home and small home office users to log into a company network, or they are used to connect company offices together over the internet at large. There are also extranets, which are a certain type of VPN, which allow business partners, such as car dealers, to access a manufacturer's website, such as Volvo, Toyota, etc. Cisco, of course, does make VPN products, and there is a little rundown of those products in your notes. We're now going to talk about bandwidth. Bandwidth is a very important term in networking. It is critical that network professionals understand the ramifications of bandwidth. Bandwidth is basically the width of the pipe, if we visualize a data connection as pipes, or the number of lanes on a highway, which shows you how many cars can travel down a highway at a given time. Bandwidth is always increasing, however, it is limited by physics and limits of the media. Optical fiber has an incredible amount of bandwidth, but until we get the technology to be able to use it optimally, there are limits to the amount of data that can be sent across optical fiber. As bandwidth increases, users find a way to make use of that bandwidth. For example, back in 1994, we had a 10 megabit Ethernet at Tamworth TAFE. One person watching a Betty Boo video off the main file server would result in the network grinding to a halt. These days, in the days of gigabit Ethernet, watching one video from one person would not bring the network to a screaming halt. However, notice that there are applications that do make use of gigabit technologies and utilize all of the available bandwidth. It's very important as a network professional that you plan for the growth and expansion of your business and install proper bandwidth based on the needs of the organization. If we picture bandwidth as a network of pipes, we can look at the fact that large city pipes may be 2 meters in diameter and carry lots of water for the city, whereas the pipe to your kitchen sink may be 2 centimeters in diameter. This is why network professionals often say that they need to install a larger pipe if they need more bandwidth. There are two types of bandwidth, digital bandwidth and analog bandwidth. Digital bandwidth is usually measured in bits per second, which refers to the number of bits of information passed a given point in, you guessed it, a second. Analog bandwidth, however, is usually measured in hertz, or cycles per second, and can be given measurements such as 5 MHz, 10 MHz, or 2 kHz, which says how wide the analog channel that carries the data is. The analog bandwidth of a phone line is approximately 6 kHz, from about 200 cycles per second all the way up to 7,000 cycles per second. Note, however, that bandwidth is not the same as speed. Bandwidth is the theoretical information-carrying capacity of a link. Speed is the speed at which data travels through that link. If there is a small amount of data travelling through a link, it may be travelling at a lower speed than the maximum bandwidth of the connection. It is important also to notice that packets always travel at the same speed, regardless of the bandwidth of the connection. For example, signals along a copper wire travel somewhat slower than the speed of light. The difference between how occupied the connection is in the spacing between the data packets, not in the speed at which they travel. For example, a modem connecting to a T3 connection may only inject one packet every 200 milliseconds. However, the packets will travel at the full T3 speed. This difference is important later on in CCNA 3 and 4 when we start considering traffic shaping and traffic control. Throughput, however, is the real-world performance of a network. Whilst a network may have a theoretical bandwidth of 100 megabits per second, not all users will receive 100 megabits per second all of the time. The network resources must be shared between all of the users. This means that when you are measuring throughput, you must look at the time of day, the amount of data being transferred across the network, the type of data, and the usage pattern. Whilst networks will never go faster than their theoretical maximum bandwidth, it is also important to consider the throughput in real terms of the network. This can be affected by the media, the network interface cards, the servers, the client computers, and the behaviour and habits of the end user. As previously stated, analog bandwidth is measured in hertz, kilohertz, megahertz, and gigahertz. Examples of this, for example, are measurements of cordless phones which operate at either 900 megahertz, 2.4 gigahertz, or 5.8 gigahertz. Digital bandwidth is measured in bits per second, kilobits per second, megabits per second, or gigabits per second. And these units must be understood by the student. This course primarily deals with digital bandwidth, as we are interested in digital signals that travel across Ethernet and other networks. So when we say bandwidth, we will mean digital bandwidth rather than analog bandwidth. A layered approach to data communication. Often it is important to break down the way devices communicate into various layers. Let's take a real-world example. When two people are having a conversation, the process may go something like this. We would initially hope that somebody would have an idea and wish to communicate it. The person would then consider how that idea is to be communicated. For example, I might talk it, Geraldine might sing it, somebody else might write it on a piece of paper. Once the idea has been communicated, say spoken or sung, the other person at the other end then listens to the idea, then decodes the information from the idea, and hopefully processes it with their brain. This breaks the process of conversation down into discrete layers. When analysing network protocols, we use layers to separate out the various functions of the encoding and decoding process. The smallest piece of information that can be sent across networks is a bit. However, the next sized piece of information that is logically grouped together are packets. A packet is the smallest network unit of information that can be sent across a network that is meaningful to the network stack. The OSI reference model. OSI stands for Open Systems Interconnect, and believe me, you are going to hear more about the OSI reference model in this course than you ever wanted to. It was a model released in 1984 by ISO, which just happens to be OSI backwards. The OSI reference model has seven layers. These layers can be remembered with a little phrase. For example, please do not throw sausage pizza away. This refers to the physical layer, the data link layer, the network layer, the transport layer, the session layer, the presentation layer, and the application layer. The OSI reference model was invented to allow protocols to be compared and for the protocol units to be broken down into manageable segments. The ISO looked at protocols such as SNA, DECnet, TCP/IP, and came up with a model that attempted to describe them all. TCP, however, has been around a lot longer than the OSI reference model, and it has its own model, which has some similarities and differences to the OSI reference model. Now, it is important that as we go through a layered approach, protocols linearly prepare information for transmission across the wire. For example, if we take the OSI reference model, an application wishes to send a message. Therefore, it contacts the application layer and puts the message on the application layer. The message then travels down to the session layer. The presentation layer, I should say. I'm getting my layers out of order here. And the presentation layer makes decisions about character set and the way the data is to be presented. The next layer below that is the session layer. This controls opening and closing of a network session and ensures that a dialogue is occurring. The transport layer is responsible for error correction and error detection, also data retransmission. It ensures that the data stream gets intact from one place to another. The network layer handles addresses such as IP addresses, IPX addresses, and various other networking information. The packet then travels down to the data link layer, which concerns itself with the way that data is framed, how cyclic redundancy checksums, which you'll hear about more later, are performed, and how the data is actually put onto into frames. The lowest layer is the physical layer. It concerns itself with the wiring and the voltages and the signals to transfer the information from point A to point B. It is very important that you become infinitely familiar, perhaps more so than me in fact, with all seven layers of the OSI reference model, as they will be coming up in your test time and again. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. Physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application. The other way you can look at it is all people seem to need data processing, which is just the model looked at from the other way up. Some people wonder which way up the model in fact should go. Generally speaking, the data link layer, or sorry, the physical layer I should say, is on the bottom of the model and the application is on the top. A message travels from the top of the model down to the bottom, along the physical layer, and back up through the corresponding processes to decapsulate the information at the other side of the protocol exchange. One of the advantages to this layered approach is that it allows us to compare protocols. It also breaks the network communication process down into manageable sections. This means, for example, that if we have a network communication system, if we change one layer on the sending side and the corresponding layer on the receiving side, we don't have to disrupt the rest of the network. For example, we could change the physical connection and change, for example, coaxial cable to twisted pair cabling. This would leave all of the other layers intact, and they would function as they did before. An example of this is Ethernet, where Ethernet can be transmitted over multiple physical mediums, including twisted pair cabling, optical fiber, and coaxial. There are, however, some caveats in this, which we will cover later in the module. It is important to note that as data travels down through the OSI reference model, headers are added and trailers are added for each layer. Note, however, that each layer communicates with its corresponding layer on the other side. For example, the physical layer at the sender communicates with the physical layer of the receiver. The transport layer of the sender communicates with the transport layer of the receiver. This is known as peer-to-peer communication, as the layers are meant to understand each other's information. As the data travels through layers, it is encapsulated into what is known as PDUs, or protocol data units. These protocol data units are meant to be understood by the layers which are communicating. There is, however, the TCP/IP reference model. This was created by the Department of Defense to map out the TCP functions. It has the application layer, the transport layer, the internet layer, and the network access layer. There is also the physical layer, which the Cisco curriculum does not mention. The application layer merges in the OSI application layer, session layer, and presentation layer. The transport layer handles flow control and sequencing along with error correction. This is actually done using TCP, which is one of the protocols in the Transmission Control Internet Protocol Protocol Suite. The internet layer is responsible for addressing. It's responsible for getting packets from point 1 to point 2 and how they're going to get there, whether they're going to go through point 7, point 8, point 12, point 15, point 81, and point 9. The network access layer is responsible for figuring out how to get data on and off the network. It handles details such as framing, MAC address, and various Ethernet transport issues that often occur on TCP/IP networks. It is also worth noting that TCP uses segments. Segments are transferred from source to destination, and these segments are intended to arrive in a certain order. The network layer, however, is responsible for getting packets from one end of the network to the other. These packets can arrive out of order and at different times to that in which they were sent. The packets are then reassembled and handed up to the reassembled by the transport layer, which then puts the data stream back together. Of course, there are also the various protocols that work at TCP/IP. For example, application layer protocols, we have Telnet, SMTP, FTP, TFTP, DNS, HTTP, POP, IMAP, etc. Then there are the network layer protocols such as TCP and UDP. IP, of course, works at the network access layer and is responsible for getting packets from one end of the network to the other. And I should say that IP works at the internet layer, not the network access layer. Okay, now some similarities between the TCP layer, TCP/IP model, and the OSI reference model. They both have layers. Both have application layers, although the application layers are not the same. Both have comparable transport and network layers. Both, you need to know about both of them, otherwise you're not going to pass this course. Both assume that packets are switched. This assumes that individual packets can be transferred from source to destination and do not have to be transferred in the same order as they would be in a circuit switched network, such as the telephone system. There are differences, however. TCP/IP combines the presentation and session layers into its application layer. The OSI model obviously doesn't. TCP/IP combines the OSI data link layer and physical layers into the network access layer. TCP/IP appears simpler, however it isn't, and anybody who's read the TCP/IP book version 2.0 that's available off our website will know that it certainly is not simpler. Note that if you wish to get hold of the TCP/IP network book version 2.0, you must send a message to cavi-instructors@gots.net and specify that whilst you are willing to receive the book, you will not hand it on to anyone else. And TCP/IP is what the internet is based on, therefore it has credibility in that particular instance because so many people use it. Now the OSI reference model is a bit big, it's a bit complex, it has a lot of steps, and generally speaking you don't design too many protocols around the OSI reference model, although it is used as a base for many protocol designs. Whilst networking professionals differ as to which model you should actually be using, it's worth knowing that you need to know about both the TCP/IP model and the OSI reference model. Cisco will be using the OSI reference model because it's easier to teach with, it has more layers and funky bits, it's easier to troubleshoot with the OSI reference model, and that's the one they decided to go with. If we look at encapsulation in detail, for example an email message, it works like this. The application has to convert the email message you type into numbers that the computer can transmit. This data is then encapsulated into segments, which is sent across the transport layer. These segments are then subdivided into packets, which are sent across the network layer. These packets can be reassembled, and the other end should see the same segments in the same order as the sender is transmitting them. You then convert the packets that are in the network layer into frames that travel on the network access layer. Frames are a construct that can be transferred from one card to another or one networking device to another. The layer below this converts the frames into bits. Some sort of clocking is used so that you can actually pick up which are ones and which are zeros when they actually travel across the physical media itself. Note that an email message can transverse multiple different types of media. For example, it may start off on an Ethernet, end up on an ADSL connection, travel across some optical fiber, go across a modem, then back to ADSL, and then come back to an Ethernet network at the other end of its journey. Well, believe it or not, that concludes Module 2. Now, there's certainly a lot of information in that lecture, and I'm sure that there'll be discussions on that lecture, and we'll answer any questions you may have. So be ready to bring your questions to Friday's lecture, and we'll discuss any confusion you may be experiencing with some quite advanced networking concepts. Not all students get these concepts straight away. In fact, if you did, you'd probably go to the top of the class, even in Module 2. So note that we will be flogging these modules to death. Each of the modules will be covered as we go through the chapters of CCNA1. We'll work our way laboriously up from the physical layer all the way to the application layer as the modules progress. So be aware that this will become more clear over time. This concludes CCNA1 Module 2.